Okay, good evening, Reading Odyssey folks. My name is Andre Stepanovic. It's June 6, 2017. We are in the midst of a reading of different Greek plays from the compilation The Greek Plays, Tragedies by Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. And tonight we are prepared to talk about Oedipus Rex. And we also added Antigone, but we'll see if we get to that. If not, we can, you know, we'll make a different plan. But we're definitely going to talk about Oedipus tonight. So I welcome our participants, and I would like to open up the discussion tonight by asking for any favorite passages or interesting quotes or questions about Oedipus Rex. So when you have a question, just state your first name and then go ahead and ask your question.
This is Alan. I've got a question in context here. This play reads very much like a psychological murder mystery. Is this the first time there's a murder mystery in ancient Greek and ancient writing?
Wow. So that's a great question. It does, the plot does reveal itself that way. I don't know for sure, but I'm willing to bet it's not the first. But I can't think of any earlier, you know, plays or, you know, Herodotus, he's going to be mentioned tonight, I'm sure, because Sophocles seems to write some parallel things that relate to Herodotus, and he wrote earlier, and he kind of has this, he kind of tells his stories a little bit like this to some extent, but not to this extent. I mean, not to this psychological, you know, this psychological. It's very interesting.
Are we going to discuss?
Yeah.
Sorry. Are we going to discuss Antigone too?
We may. Yeah, we very well may.
Which one was written first? That's my question.
Ah, well, that's a good question.
The notes say Antigone.
Antigone?
Play,
yeah.
Say Antigone, yes.
Yeah. So even though Antigone is, you know, written before Oedipus, Oedipus kind of comes before it in the, you know, story chronology. So it may be good to start with Oedipus first so that we can then, you know, Antigone takes place after that. So, but yeah, Antigone is written beforehand. So, yeah.
I can throw out a favorite quote. Oh, sorry.
Okay. So who do we have here for a favorite quote?
This is Sean.
Sean.
And this is line, boy, it's super small. I think about 970. This is when the messenger has come and told them that Oedipus's presumptive father is dead. And Jocasta says, yeah, so she's basically trying to convince him it's the prophecies aren't going to come true. Why should a human being live in fear? Chances rule his life, and nothing is foreknown. It's best to live at random as one can. You too. Why dread marrying your mother? Many before, in dreams as well, have lain with their mothers. It's the man to whom all this means nothing who will get along most easily. Oedipus replies, I wouldn't fault anything you've said if my mother weren't alive. As it is, no matter what you say, I'm afraid. Jocasta, still, your father's death is a bright light. I mean, as far as I understand that passage, she's basically saying, it's great that your dad is dead, and who cares if you sleep with your mom?
Yeah. So that begs the question, right? How much does she really know, or...
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I then, like, when I got to the end, I'm like, you know, I was thinking back on that passage, and I'm like, was that after the part where where they mentioned Oedipus's feet being bound, you know, the messenger messenget. And that actually came a few steps later. Because I was wondering if maybe, like, she had kind of, oh, the feet being bound would be a big clue, and she would have figured it out by then. But actually, I think it's about a, you know, it's a few paragraphs later that they kind of have that conversation.
Uh-huh.
But it did make me wonder if she kind of already knew the jig was up, so to speak.
Right. Well, she definitely knows more than he does at any point, but she doesn't know for sure if he is, right, if he is the one. Unless, that's a good question. Thoughts?
Yeah, hi, this is Stuart. I didn't really, I mean, I thought it was, I had the same interest in that same line, you too, why dread marrying your mother, many before in dreams. I sort of saw it as sort of the whole underlying thing that there's this tragedy is always there, you know, below the surface. You know, this, you know, in some ways, yes, she's trying to sort of say, you know, what's the big deal? But for us, it's sort of like, you know, here's this horror always below the surface. Because, I mean, the amazing thing about this play is that, you know, as opposed to Orestes, Oedipus did nothing wrong. I mean, he tried to do everything right. He sort of, you know, he escaped from Corinth in order to avoid this problem. He solved the Sphinx's riddle, and he still, you know, suffers a worse tragedy. He can't escape his fate at all. It sort of comes, you know, crashing down on him. So anyway, it was very powerful. You know, and it's very different from Antigone, where people, you know, are actually making decisions that sort of, you know, are either right or wrong, tragic or not. Oedipus, I mean, unless people disagree, I can't see that he did anything. You know, he tried to avoid tragedy and got caught up in it. That's a very powerful statement.
This is Elizabeth. Yeah, I mean, that's why I was so shocked by Antigone, because I took Oedipus as reflecting Sophocles and maybe the culture's belief in fate, which I think you see in Homer as well. And here, in Antigone, it's completely different. It's a completely different outlook. It's more like King Lear. You know, you have flaws, you're sort of morally or ethically blind, or you make mistakes, and then you and other people suffer the consequences, and it was avoidable.
Yeah, I think you're right, guys. They're making great points that these two plays are very different in that respect. Yeah. Other thoughts?
I mean, the other thing that's so odd about the two plays, just, I know we're not, we're going to discuss them separately, is Creon is two different characters. I mean, in Oedipus, he's sort of, you know, innocent. He's, you know, he's blamed for something he didn't do. He kind of has a, you know, is a decent, normal, you know, person. In Antigone, he's, you know, he's a horror. It's interesting to think that Sophocles thought it was okay to write, you know, the same character, but two totally different, inconsistent personalities. Well,
I don't think it's inconsistent.
Not,
I think it's the thing, power corrupts.
Right.
What happens when your people are put into positions of power? Because he even says in Oedipus, why would I want to be king? I have nothing to worry about here. I don't have to worry about people trying to take my throne. I have all the power, but I don't have to do anything.
Right.
And he becomes tyrant or king, whatever. I guess he was king because he was descended from, he was brother. No, he was actually Iocasta's brother, so he was tyrant, I guess. But
power didn't corrupt.
Oedipus.
But Oedipus wasn't corrupted by power, right?
Right.
I mean, was he?
But Creon is.
Yeah,
Creon.
But he accuses Creon of plotting against him when Creon wasn't. So even though he might not have been corrupted by power, he still was not he was paranoid. He accused Creon of having Tiresias say these things.
Right.
And it's funny because I thought, again, we're kind of doing them at the same time now, but in Antigone, Creon accuses someone else of doing the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
That he defended himself
right.
against Oedipus, and then he goes and does it to somebody else.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But
well, this
yeah,
is
I
Alan.
Mean,
I would. This is Alan. I'd suggest that maybe Creon is not as pure in Oedipus as we think. If you go look at the end of the play, how rapidly he pushes Oedipus out and assumes power. I mean, it is a swift, brutal takeover. And so I don't think Creon is quite as clean as we all are beginning to think about.
Let's take a moment to look at that, right? Let's go to the end and just take a quick look at that. I'm looking at around lines 14, 20 or so. Creon comes in and he says, "I haven't come to mock you, Oedipus." This is line 14:22. "Nor scold you for the wrongs you've done." And into the chorus, "But you hear, if you aren't ashamed in the sight of men, be ashamed at least before the sun that nurtures all. Ashamed to display like this unhidden such pollution, which neither earth nor sacred rain nor light of day will bear. But quickly as you can, bring him inside. Only one's kin can decently look on or listen to the evils done by kin." So here's where he starts to take charge. Now, is he being sympathetic here? Is he trying to help Oedipus? Is he trying to take the opportunity to get rid of him? You know, that's a good question. That's a very good question. Oedipus doesn't leave the stage at that moment. He talks with Creon a little bit. But then
Oedipus asks, like, hurl me, like, grant me my wish, hurl me from this land. And Creon's like, "Oh, no, I have to check with the gods. I have to." So it's not like he's pushing him out. He's like, "No, I've got to check with the gods and make sure we do what they want."
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's pushing him out. I mean, he's basically saying, "I haven't figured out what the hell I'm going to do with you yet, but you ain't king anymore, tyrant."
Yeah. I think that's clear, right?
But that feels appropriate. I mean, right? Oedipus was the one who framed up whoever killed this dude. Like the whole mom thing was extraneous. Like it was the killing of Laius.
Yes, King Laius, right?
That, you know, in theory banned him from the country.
Bonus. You have to remember, you know, when you're talking about Creon, actually didn't do anything except. Oedipus actually was the one who removed himself from power, because by ancient law, in blinding himself, he stepped down from the throne.
But the blinding came after he'd been booted.
Okay, so the blinding comes a little later than this. They're true. That's right. But we can already start to see that Oedipus is almost giving in to Creon here and accepting this judgment. And maybe it's because, think about this, maybe it's because Laius was slain by Oedipus, and that makes him a regicide. And maybe that automatically, you know, negates him from being able to rule, which
he's
is...
usurping throne.
Yeah. Maybe that comes into play, because that's something, you know, we say Oedipus didn't do anything wrong. And, yeah, I understand, but he did kill somebody, and it just happened to be the king of
kings. Exactly.
I have a question on that, too. And I don't think it's ever kind of mentioned or explained, even in the foreword or the afterword or anything. Was there a reason given? Was he just poor and needed money and killed him? He left his home and the person he thought was his father because of this... oracle or this, you know, fate. But why did he kill King Laius? Was it just...
Yeah.
He killed Laius because he was rude to him.
Yeah,
is that it?
Okay.
I mean, he wouldn't yield on the road.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
He was mean to bicyclists.
To differ and go back to my previous point.
Yes.
It's line 1298, Oedipus okay. emerges from the palace blinded. Oedipus
oh,
has
okay.
surrendered the throne.
Yes. He's done. He has surrendered the throne at that point because... So I just want to get this thing about Creon right, because Creon, everyone says it's absolute power. Creon's real problem is fear. He is afraid of everything, and he has seen that Oedipus has given up his power. He has seen that by right and law, Oedipus is no longer king. He has heard that the person who has committed this crime has to leave the land, that the land is going to be cured from the plague. And what is his response? Oh, I better go ask the gods.
Yeah.
Well, said, but in this crisis, it's better to inquire what must be done. Creon
yeah.
is really, really, really timid. And with the death of Eteocles and Polynices in Antigone, he suddenly plunged where he didn't want to be and is now convinced that all those things he thought were going to happen to him in this play are actually going to happen to him there. And his mm. fear is his tragic flaw, as it were. I don't think it's the lust for power. I think it's just sheer terror. He's a very timid character.
Wow. That's a great point. And by the way, I my apologies. You're absolutely right. He did blind himself previously to that. I think that is the moment, like you said, where Oedipus abdicates. Is that right? Is that how you would see it?
Yep.
So to speak?
Yep.
Especially here.
Okay.
But I mean,
and
Oedipus.
So,
Oedipus can't stay there. The whole point is that, you know, Thebes is, you know, the children are dying, the crops are not growing, and all of this is because there's this pollution. And who is the pollution? It's Oedipus. So there's
yes.
no possibility that he can remain as king. And in fact, he can't remain in Thebes. He has to leave. And his job is to find out, you know, what's the pollution. So I think all of this business about did he depose himself or was he deposed, that was never going to happen once the truth was known that he could remain. In fact, by his own decree, he couldn't remain. But I want to point out something else, which is that Oedipus certainly remembers that he killed three people. And he killed them on a road at a certain time before he came to Thebes. So when he's accused of having killed Laius, he's really, and he, you know, totally rejects it. That's a little bit, it's not because he's never killed somebody or he doesn't, you know, remember. I mean, that's a pretty serious thing. And he doesn't know who he killed, but he knows it was a person of some importance who was in a carriage, who had servants and a slave and so on. So, I mean, maybe everybody had slaves, but this was clearly sort of an important person. And he's very resistant and totally rejects it. And then there's a one point in the play, and I can't remember the line, but when he suddenly hesitates and starts to ask questions. And that's when it's kind of, he gets the inkling that maybe it's him, and I think that's a very dramatic moment.
That's a great point. I think now I'm thinking about Jocasta and how she is vehemently opposed to the idea that, oh, you married your mother, how silly, you know, and she kind of blows that off at first as well. And yet she,
yeah, but to be,
yeah.
This is Sean. To be fair, she knows less than, well, I guess that's not quite true. Like, she knows she threw away a baby, but he knows that he killed someone. I mean, I had the same reaction, but then I kind of admired Sophocles because there was the presumption that a person of Laius' standing would go with a much bigger entourage, right? And he had heard the story that he was killed by bandits. Yeah, you know, so I think it was easier for Oedipus to dismiss, because my first reaction was, hey, you know, they just said you killed your dad or killed this dude, and maybe you did because you killed someone. You know, I mean, but I think he structured in a way that Oedipus had more than just like plausible deniability. Like, it wouldn't occur to you that those were the same event until that three roads, bit of information kind of came out.
This is Frank. I just joined. I think Jocasta knew.
You do? You think she knew it?
I think she knew it.
When?
Later on, like around, 1050, 1060, that whole dialogue in there is like, no, let's not talk about that. Let's forget about that part. Don't talk about that part, Oedipus. It was like she didn't want the truth to come out because she knew what the truth was going to be. I think at that point she knew.
But I don't think that, I don't think at this earliest stage she knew. Although I do think, I think somebody has said it before, like there is a certain, she's just like, let's just not dig shit up. Like it's not going to end well if we dig shit up. Let's not do that. Like I do feel like she's got that kind of, bias in her personality. But I feel like that was more generic to, the prophecies are always nonsense and they lead to bad things. So let's just kind of ignore them rather than.
Yeah. And this is Nan.
Except that it was her idea to send the kid to die.
Okay. Now,
it was the class's idea to send the child, to the mountain to die, not Laius's.
Oh, really?
I read that was in there somewhere.
Okay. Nan, what were we going to say?
Yep. Well, she even says in that passage that people just referenced about, let's not talk about this, let's not bring stuff up. She even says, doomed man, may you never know who you are. That's pretty...
Yes. Yeah, what line is that? That's
pretty telling.
It's about 1070? Yeah.
1070, yeah.
That's the line.
It's at the bottom of page 2. Is that 259?
Yeah, 259.
Yeah. Interesting. Yep. Yeah.
But unless I'm remembering it wrong, she doesn't really react to the murder. It's not a murder. To the defense that led Oedipus to kill Laius and his men. I mean, that's not the point at which she's sort of shocked. It's only when things start to come together later. I mean, which makes me wonder if, why wasn't she horrified by that? Maybe it wasn't such a crime. Maybe she understood that Oedipus was defending himself. Because I don't think, I don't remember that she began to react in that way until, things start to come together with the shepherd and the fact that Oedipus isn't really the son of, Polybus, so on and so on. It's not until things start to come together. I mean, it's kind of surprising. I don't know. What was her reaction when she found out that, because Oedipus admits it. He said, was there an old guy there? Yeah, I killed him. But I don't think she reacts that much, does she?
Well, maybe her cover was blown, and that's why she started acting a little differently.
Yeah,
I don't think she's all that innocent.
I'm really starting to realize how complex Jocasta's position is. I mean, she might be feeling guilty about not only abandoning her child, but now that her child, if she's starting to realize, when she realizes it's her child, has killed. Her abandonment led to the killing of her own husband by her own child. I mean, she's really in a bad place. I mean, and that always kind of slid by me. I was always focused on Oedipus, but now I'm really sad for Jocasta. She's really in a bad place.
Well, and I also have a question on that, because it said that in the preface about that because he solved the riddle of the Sphinx, Oedipus became the tyrant, and because of that, he got Jocasta as his mate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like, even though they did have four children together, it doesn't sound like it was a love match. I don't know, maybe they did love each other eventually, but I never got the feeling that there was this great romance and that she was basically a prize trophy.
Right. That's another aspect. Yeah.
I don't know if it's so much that she's the prize, but that the legitimacy of his rule is sort of cemented by the fact that is his wife, I think. So I don't see her as a prize in that case, but as the necessary match in order to legitimize the throne, as it were.
Well, he saved the city from the Sphinx. That's why he's a tyrant.
It could be that, but it could be something else. I mean, it's not fleshed out. It could also be that she was the greatest catch, and that because he was such a hero, he was able to win her.
Because they don't talk about any other heirs to the throne. They had no children because they tried to kill Oedipus because of the oracle.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is, and I mean, it's just speculation, is that because the text doesn't tell us, since he killed the Sphinx, he was going to be king, and he was a great hero, so he was the leader. I mean, the leadership, it seems, I mean, we're assuming that it's hereditary, but it doesn't need to be hereditary, and it seems that Sophocles has a very democratic spirit, you know, the guards and the Tiresias and whatnot, people speak up. They speak to the king. They may even be afraid of the king the way they are of Creon, but they have a very, you know, independent and democratic spirit there. And they sort of don't say, oh, you're the king, so you're God. It's not like that at all. And in the case of Oedipus, since he had slain the Sphinx, I think he was entitled to become the king since there was no king. And it's certainly possible. I'm just saying it certainly could have been a match, which was, you would say, a love match that, you know, like Othello, you know, being a hero and getting his pick of brides.
I'm looking at page 222.
All right, what's the line?
It's not a line. It's in the introduction. And it says, he saved the city, gaining its empty throat as his reward and for his mate, the widow of Laius, the previous ruler. It doesn't say anything about, you know, it's just saying, okay, he solved the riddle, so he gets the kingdom and the wife. And that's, you know.
We'll look at it from another point of view. Jocasta was the queen. All of a sudden, she's a widower, a widow. Here comes a new guy, new boss. She says, if I want to preserve my position, I need to get him.
Yeah, and she doesn't have any heirs since Oedipus, right? Because the prophecy.
So if she doesn't get Oedipus with her, she's done. She's nobody. So maybe she has a motivation as well.
That's what I'm saying. That's basically my point. Is she had no choice. Like she.
Yeah.
She made a choice.
And women in that society had no say. They, you know, were at the whatever men decided. You know, the fickleness of men. Because I remember in the, I forget the play now, when we did the comedies, there was the line about, you know, man, if we get old, we can't marry again. Yes, but an old man can get a young woman, but once a woman gets old, she can't get a guy anymore. And it's just, and so that's my point.
I would like to add this too, because I think I'm seeing this. The fact that the city had been without an heir, right, for so long, and then Laius is killed, and then they have this plague and everything, right? I mean, the city is dying to see something happen as far as some stability. And when Oedipus shows up and you know, solves the riddle and then gives the chance now for Jocasta to produce an heir and to get things back to normal, so to speak. She, of course, couldn't resist that. The whole city is expecting this to happen. And why shouldn't it, right? Because they need that stability in their leadership. They have to have it. And then suddenly they have, four kids, right? Something like that. So it looks like it's gonna stabilize things, but it's
on the other hand, you know, if Jocasta actually believes the prophecy, But things start going south because her husband is dead. She may start to think, well, maybe the prophecy has come true. Who is this guy? Where did he come from?
Yeah, that's the one thing that gets kind of slips by. But he tells them he's from wherever it is, Corinth or someplace, right? He believes he's from, you know, and he says it with conviction. I mean, he actually believes it. So it's still hidden. The whole secret, the dirty secret's hidden. You know, it stays hidden. So,
does a mother recognize her son even after 20 years?
Yeah, well,
it's a 20-year thing, right?
I don't know. I mean, that's.
I don't know either.
This is how I'm not sure. I have a kind of a comment here about Oedipus. To me, he's a man of action. He solves a very difficult riddle. You know, he's the hero. He sees the plague. He sends Creon out. But for some reason, when Tiresias comes in, Tiresias tells him twice that, you know, what the solution is and what the answer to the murder is and all that. And it, you know, most clearly is in lines begin about 446 through 460. But for some reason, why doesn't Oedipus figure that out? And he continues to dig and dig and dig, and it's really Oedipus that's driving finding the solution to the murder mystery. And he's been told the answer at the beginning of the play, but why doesn't he listen? Is that his flaw?
Well, I think it's part of it for sure. I'm thinking now about the meeting at the crossroads and how fateful that really was, because if Oedipus is anything, he's definitely impetuous, right? He's definitely, he killed somebody, right, over a slight. Now, what I know is from reading, you know, ancient literature, is there's a very important aspect to stories called a recognition scene. And if this story were to play out differently, that was the moment where Oedipus could have met his father. And, you know, I know it didn't happen, but I mean, he could have met his father and they could have been reunited, like in the Odyssey, you know, where Odysseus and his father get back together, and also Odysseus and his son. So I think that didn't happen here. And instead, it turned out the opposite. It was the worst result, rather than the best. And that's on Oedipus. I mean, there's no question about it. It doesn't get a lot of, it doesn't seem to get a lot of emphasis, but it is the underlying, you know, secret here. And it's the twist that goes against the tradition of recognition in ancient stories.
I'm sorry, this is Sean.
Yeah.
Can whoever said that last line, I lost the last bit of it. You said, is that his tragic flaw? What was it that you said was his tragic, was maybe his tragic flaw?
I think he's also impetuous. I think he's, I mean, that can be a really good trait, you know, if you need to make decisions quickly. I mean, he does that and he pokes his eyes out, you know, and he gives in to the inevitable, I've got to leave, you know, I have to leave and I don't want to see anything. But it's also what led him to kill his father. You know, maybe, I don't know. What do you guys think?
I buy into the impetuous.
I don't agree.
Okay, so let's hear one at a time. So who agrees?
To the I don't agree first.
Okay, yeah, let's go with the don't agree. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I always thought of Greek tragedy as a part of somebody working, you know, somebody's tragic flaw coming to light. But now I think I was wrong. This Oedipus was cursed by the gods from birth. I mean, Odysseus recognized his father because he'd seen him before. And he recognizes, you know, he actually, his son recognized him, but Oedipus never had a chance. I mean, yes, he had a horrible temper, and that was, you know, certainly a flaw, but if he hadn't met his father on the road, it never would have been a problem. I mean, think of all the things that had to happen for that meeting to even take place.
Right.
I mean, his father had to try to kill him, but not actually kill him. The shepherd had to hand him off to the man who happened to take him to Corinth, where he happened to grow up and then come back. And you know, I'm a stranger, you know, after he kills Laius, I'm a stranger. You know, I'm entitled to be here. You know, his tragic flaw was that the gods hated him. I don't think there's any other answer.
Yeah,
so I agree.
No, it's like appointment in Samara. You can't avoid your fate.
Okay.
Right. And that, I think that's a recurring theme. But he still was impetuous. I mean, even, you know, like you said, he was decisive, but his, like, hey, get me this dude. You know, get me the shepherd so I can talk to him. His killing of the king. I think everything is very quick. And it's interesting, I think, given the point that was made earlier about Creon, is the total opposite, right? Which is, you know, Creon is maybe too deliberative. But I feel like Oedipus, yeah, he jumped on everything instantaneously, and it didn't always work out for him.
Yeah, but this is Elizabeth. You know? I just want to interject that your character is also something you don't choose, and the kind of person you are, I mean, it could work out very well, it could work out badly, but I don't think people necessarily, I don't know what the Greek view is, but it seems to me that, you know, in Antigone you see that people have choice and people can change. But often in life, people don't have a choice about who they are. They just are who they are. And that's part of your fate.
Now,
listen to that.
I have a comment. Oh, I'm sorry.
I wanted to take a different look at it.
Oh, I'm sorry. The impetuous thing. Actually, the more I think about it, I don't know what the characteristic about Oedipus, both with the Sphinx and with his pursuit of saying, no, tell me what it is, tell me. This is a guy who represents real knowledge. I mean, you know, he was able to solve the Sphinx. He's not going to, it would have been easier for him to say, Tiresias, you don't want, you think it's too horrible, I don't want to hear about it. It's not just, this is a guy who's driven by a quality that I think we admire, and that is, he wants to get to the truth of things. So I don't know. I mean, I can see where the impetuousness might be applied in terms of his reaction to Laius, though I still think that Laius and his entourage attacked Oedipus. I think that Oedipus, what if he hadn't pursued that knowledge? What if he had been, more restrained and said, okay, I guess we can't really know. In fact, he was, somebody said before, it's like a crime story. He was like a detective. He wanted to sort of keep at it and say, what's really going on here? And actually, it's hard not to admire that as a character element, even though it turned out to be his undoing.
Yeah.
You know what? I just wanted to make one comment. You know, I remember reading in the preface that, you know, Sophocles was very skeptical about the power of the gods and was really kind of secular. So I wonder if he wrote this whole story to kind of say, you know, people say prophecies and all this tragedy happened because people believe in prophecies, but in fact, it's all a bunch of nonsense. Oedipus was a decent guy. He was a tyrant. You know, whether or not he killed Laius on the road is really inconsequential. People feeding into some prophecy that may not have anything basis in fact created all this tragedy when in fact there was probably no reason for it. I just wonder if he was just trying to debunk the whole prophecy thing through the story. Is just kind of a step back and look at it from a further away.
This is Alan. I'm not sure impetuous is the right frame. I think he's a man of action who's very smart, who wants to dig in, but he's got a blind spot and he doesn't listen because, I mean, I just go to line 362 where Torea says very bluntly, you are the killer you're looking for. But Oedipus won't, just ignores that. And he says it a couple more times. You are it.
Yeah, but I have to say, he's like the biggest dick in this whole show. Right? I mean, like, isn't he, I mean, like, the thing that he struck me as is that guy at work who is usually right, but is such an jerk in the way he presents his information that nobody wants to listen to him. Like, that was my reaction. I'm like, boy, I have worked with that guy. I may have been that guy at work, but it's just like he was just so obnoxious about it that I totally would have dismissed him too.
Well, but isn't this during the part where Oedipus thinks Creon has put him up to this?
Well, that's the conclusion he leaps to, but Oedipus welcomes him in there to begin with.
Right.
He says, Matt, you're the master of all that can and can't be taught. So, I mean, he has a lot of respect for Torreus, but because Torreus doesn't give him the answer he wants, he shuts him down.
No, I disagree with that. Yeah, so I agree. He brings him in. He wants him there. He wants to find the truth. But, like, the guy doesn't explain anything. He doesn't explain that he's known this for 20, 30 years. I don't even know how long it's been. Maybe 10, 5, whatever. Like, I feel like he just, because Oedipus continues, I think somebody else just pointed out, right? Oedipus continues to pursue the truth. Even when it's clear it's not wise, and even when he says with that shepherd, like, you don't want to say it, I don't want to know it, but we need to hear it. So he's pursuing truth. So it's not, I don't think he shuts him down because he doesn't want to hear it. I think he shuts him down because he presents it in a way that is just like, is just asinine.
Well,
The problem I have there is that I don't think Oedipus is all that admirable either. Of all of the characters in any of the plays I've read, he's the one I like the least. I think he's a jerk. I think he is impetuous is a kind way of saying it. He is self-involved, and he asks to hear the truth and then doesn't listen to it, then goes on pursuing the truth until he reaches it, even though everyone says leave it alone. He knows better than everyone. I found Oedipus just completely like, who cares? Just
now,
die
already. I want to come alongside you there for a second. It's Stephen, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there is another thing about ancient culture that strikes me as interesting. When you meet a stranger, Zeus or Jupiter was the god of, guest friendship or strangers, and you were supposed to welcome the strangers when you saw them. You were supposed to protect them, and that was without asking anything in return, and that was without even trying to find out if they were a criminal or not. Now, I know that sounds crazy, but in the Odyssey, it comes up a lot, especially with, Odysseus goes into the cave of the Cyclops. Everybody says, what a nut, why did he do it? But he actually went in there thinking, well, we'll be received kindly because that's what Greeks do. Well, he misjudged that one. But anyway, when Oedipus meets someone on the road and he winds up, and it is obviously a person of importance, right? Not only did he not show respect, but he went against the gods. He went against Zeus. He went against the god of guests and strangers. So maybe that has something to do with it. I mean, I know I keep coming back to this, but I hadn't really thought about this before. So and maybe that figures into this. Maybe it gives him some ownership of this. And it's not all just, he had nothing to do with this. Maybe there is some free will in here, is what I'm trying to say. Sorry.
Well, I was going to almost say the opposite, that I think Oedipus is, not wanting to hear it, and I think it's human nature. It's like the five stages of grief. He was in denial. You know, like, how can this be true? This can't be true. I actually did kill my father when I tried not to. And the whole horror is just too much for him to deal with.
Right.
And
I agree.
We do it today. And it's just like, no, you're lying. Creon put you up to this. That can't be the truth. You know, and so he keeps digging because I have to find the truth. And I have to come up with another story because this can't be true.
Yeah, and being the king at the moment, or tyrant, whatever you want to call him, he is used to being able to use his influence to divert people, and you know. But this Tiresias doesn't take that bait, right? Yeah, I think we're in agreement here. That's really interesting. Yeah, but I, you know, it may be as we're saying, it may be, you know, completely. He just doesn't have any control over any of it. And, you know, and maybe even to the point where Sophocles is writing something that's almost a parody, right? But on the other hand, I want us to think about that Oedipus does have some freedom of choice, that he does have free will. But he may have made one bad decision, you know? And sorry.
No, that's okay. This is Sean. So I think someone said before, and I agree, which is he kind of made all the right choices, like, and it ended horribly for him. So I think he had free will. He expressed his free will in a way that was you know, righteous, just, whatever we want to call it.
But did he have to kill that guy? You know, did he have to kill the guy on the road?
He didn't have to kill that guy, but I mean, but at the same time, I think, you know, I mean, I'm reading some other literature, and it's just nasty. People killed people. Like, I mean, it's just,
who knows what happened.
But that's what I'm saying. That it, like, that was the time in a way, and so I would say, yeah, he might not have had to do that, but who knows that they're in the right either. But I guess my point is, most of the time he. You know, he tried to save his father by leaving town. He just didn't have all the information he needed about who his father was.
Just a point of clarification on the confrontation on the road. It's outlined here on, I guess, about 806, that both, he says, the man in front and the older man as well, both tried to force me off the road. The driver who was pushing me, I struck in anger. The older man, when he saw that, watched till I was passing, then came down on my head with his double-pointed goad. So this was a meeting not well met by either party.
True.
Self-defense.
Absolutely.
I
now,
have a question. I don't quite remember, but Oedipus, the father that he thought was his father in Corinth, wasn't he also a nobleman or not? I mean,
yeah,
he was a king.
So Oedipus, it wasn't as if Oedipus is some, you know, lowly slob, you know, killing, you know, Laius the king. He's also someone with a, you know, some sense of position,
right.
You know, who would, you know, might justifiably feel that he's being offended by these
True.
Other. He doesn't know the other people are kings. He might have seen them as bandits. You know,
True.
I mean, he's, you know, he's nobility also.
That's true. And so his hubris, right? He assumed that he was at least equal, if not better than this guy that he met on the road. And
no, that's not hubris. That's
no?
not hubris. I mean, he's asking for a reasonable amount of respect. Like, I mean, at least, you know, I we're all basing this on whatever, five lines. But,
yeah,
so I don't feel like, yeah, I'm on Oedipus' side, actually.
I'm not. Obviously, this is a person of some substance in that time. He's in a carriage. He's got drivers. He's got people in front of him. This is a person who is the equivalent of his father, a king. Oedipus is not a king. You step off the road. That's what you did at the time, period. That's what you did. You didn't hog the road. You didn't do your own thing. You didn't stand in front of him. You stepped off the road. Was it right or wrong? That's a different issue. I mean, I don't want to get into that. But the point is,
know.
He deliberately flew in the face of what it was proper to do to a person of substance. and then killed him.
But Oedipus felt that he was a prince. He didn't know that he was not the son of the king of Corinth. He felt he was a prince.
He was the son of another king. He was the son of a king, regardless of who his father was.
He was another king. He was walking down the road.
Even as a
and these guys, and the driver decides to smack him instead of asking who you are. I could see how he got pissed off.
Well, yeah,
and he started hitting him, and he hit back.
But,
so, you know.
But, yeah.
But at the same time, we only have Oedipus' side of what happened. And, you know, there are many, you know, many times people will say something, and the other person has a totally different viewpoint of really what transpired. And he might think he was snubbed, and the other people are like, I didn't snub him. So we only have one side of the story, too.
Didn't the shepherd corroborate to some degree the fact that Oedipus was disrespected?
I
wouldn't say the shepherd necessarily corroborated it, but the fact that the story was originally told as the king was accosted by bandits might suggest that Oedipus, as a lone man, was otherwise at a disadvantage, because they had to embellish the story for him to be a whole series of bandits.
Over the cover story.
Yeah. Shameful.
Let me add this. On line 450, 451, Tiresias is confronting Oedipus. He says, and I tell you, this man, referring to Oedipus, well, referring to the person who you're looking for, right? The murderer of Laius. This man, the one you've long been looking for with threats and proclamations about the death of Laius, he's here, a guest from abroad, so they say, but soon to emerge a native Theban. And so there's that guest business again. They've received Oedipus as a guest into their city, and at the same time, he's the one who killed their king. It's very ironic. But then they find out that that's not even the end of it, that he's also a Theban himself. So now he's a patricide, not just a regicide. Whoever did what, you know, at the crossroads, we don't have the full account, but it still doesn't end up to Oedipus's credit. That's the problem, right? It really doesn't help him at all. So anyway, I'm just starting to notice these things this time around. It's really interesting. Let's see. Now let me ask you, bear with me on this. Phil, when I talked to him earlier, he asked me to present this to y'all. So if you would turn with me to the end of the play, it's page 274, and it's the last little paragraph spoken by the chorus leader. And it presents something rather interesting. And this is how the play ends. I don't want to end the conversation here, obviously. I just want to bring this up because I think it's going to spark a little bit of discussion. So chorus leader says, "Dwellers in our native Thebes, behold, here is Oedipus, who solved the famous riddle and rose to power. What citizen did not look upon his life with envy? So see what he's come to. What a wave of grim disaster washed over him, a warning to us all. Bide the coming of that final day, counting no man happy till he has crossed life's boundary, free of pain."
Yeah.
So, yeah, what do you think of that?
That's a very famous line.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's only from here or this is the first time it's said. But,
Bill said it's in Herodotus, too.
Uh-huh.
He said it's in Herodotus, and Herodotus wrote earlier than Sophocles. So who knows, you know, who knows if Sophocles got it from Herodotus or what have you. But, you know, what do you think about this whole idea? Is it a philosophical, specifically a philosophical question? Is it an ethical question? Is it a, you know?
I think it's philosophical. I mean, you know.
Okay. So
I just feel it.
Yeah.
I just feel it's psychological because literally, I mean, it means that until you're dead, no one can say whether you were happy or not. So life is not addition. It isn't like I had 10 great years and then I had 2 bad years. So basically, I had a happy life. No, that you have to look at the whole thing. And if at the end, if you really suffer the way Oedipus and Jocasta did, then your life was not a happy life, because at the end it was terrible. And I think that that's a, I'm not sure it's true or not, you know, but I do think we all, I mean, I believe in fate. I think people do have fate, and you don't really know what your fate is. So it's really what your future is, you know. Is something terrible going to happen or something not terrible? I mean, you just don't know. So I don't know if it's philosophy or if it's just or it's just a way of looking at it, because you could look at it and say, yes, you know, my last 5 years were spent in pain, but before that my life was pretty great, so I'm not complaining. Or you could say, no, this throws, you know, I spent my last 5 years in jail, and that makes everything else, you know, not a worthwhile life. You know, and I don't know the answer. I don't really have, I'm sorry if you're talking so long, but, you know, I do think about this. And I don't have an answer.
Nan? Yeah, go ahead, Nan.
That actually reminded me of a line earlier in the play that I had actually written down, because as I read, I write down, like, you know, things I like and passages and stuff. And line 87 around, Creon says, "The news is good on the whole, for even hardships, if they come out right, are fortunate." So it kind of reminded me of that, saying that, yeah, even if you have bad things happen, you can still have a happy life. And okay. And so you can't, you know, you have to judge the whole life. You can't just say, oh, you know, when Oedipus's life is a little different. His, I don't think, was a happy life at the end. But, you know, one thing doesn't necessarily make a life happy or not happy. Like he's saying, oh, he was king. He had all this power and all this respect. But in the end, he wasn't happy.
Well,
and we're early in the play.
He's
saying, oh, you can have a hardship, but it can still be fortunate.
Certain parts of the play, basically they say that, you know, the way you die is who you are in Hades. That's how you exist for the rest of eternity. So maybe that's what it is. On your last day, that defines the rest of eternity for you.
But I think
the way you are when you go to Hades is what you're going to wind up with.
This whole passage undercuts itself, and I think actually shows us something that Sophocles may have been up to. It sounds a little bit like Polonius and Hamlet with all of his truisms. And I have to look at it and say, tell me who it is who has crossed life's boundary free of pain. Who is that person? What person hasn't experienced suffering or pain or died painfully? I mean, there is no person. And I think Sophocles is kind of almost undercutting what he says before this by saying, you know, this isn't true either. There is no conclusion you can draw from this. This happened. It's what it is. It's the way it went. And Oedipus made some choices. He made choices. He blinded himself. He decided that nothing was worth living for after that discovery. Why? Okay, so bad things happened. Let's leave Thebes. That would be my attitude.
Okay. Let's hear from someone else. That's good. Let's hear from someone else. I
just want to say one more thing, and I'm sorry to talk so much, but I do think that the line in the play is actually how people view it. I mean, you take a life that is hugely successful, like Bill Cosby's, that now he's in court, okay? So most people would say, yes, all that was great, but actually it's canceled out by the fact that now this bad thing is happening. And at the same time, if you die, you know, peacefully in your sleep or something, surrounded by your family, then people will think, oh yes, that was a good life. It's, people do look at the end.
Yeah. Let me jump in here. I've got Herodotus, book one, chapter 32. I'm going to read this to you real quickly. King Croesus is the character here at this part. And he is the richest, you know, king at that time. He's the king of Sardis. He has more wealth than anybody else. But Herodotus is going to explain how Croesus was defeated by the Medes and the Persians. And before that happens, Croesus is visited by Solon, a Greek tyrant. And Solon says this to Croesus. Croesus is, at this point, still living a good life. He hasn't been defeated or anything. And Solon says this. He says to Croesus, "You seem to be very wealthy, and you rule over many people, but I cannot tell you the answer you asked for about, you know, how do you determine a happy life. I can't give you the answer that you asked for until I learn how you have ended your life. You see, the man who is very wealthy is no more happy and prosperous than the man who has only enough to live from day to day, unless good fortune stays with him and he retains his fair and noble possessions right up until he departs this life happily." And so on. And he goes on to say this. And then prophetically, Croesus then loses his son, and then he gets defeated, and he becomes pretty much like Oedipus. You know, he's kind of turned into that. So, just interestingly enough, it was in Herodotus. It may be true, but they doubt it because Solon may not have been alive when Croesus was alive. Anyway, yeah, there's a little bit of little issues with that, but. So yeah, can we read this play differently in that way? Can we, you know, I mean, is it supposed to be open to these different interpretations we have? Because I'm not saying we have to come to an agreement here, you know. I just think it's very interesting how we are reading it differently.
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, and so we read different things into it that may have been that in the thought patterns, you know, 3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
It gives the opportunity to look at ideas from a fresh perspective from the way our lives here are, you know, in the 21st century. I think that's you know, part of the beauty of what we've been doing for the last 9 years.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. What does this mean by the last line, "No counting no man happy till he has crossed life's boundary, free of pain"? Does that mean to be free from pain, or to simply live without pain, and then you can say...
I think it means to die.
Yeah?
Well, yeah, but I think, I mean, it means to die satisfied.
Okay.
I think... Someone said earlier, like, that, you know, no one's going to not have any pain in their life. I don't think that's realistic. But, you know, Oedipus is kind of done. Like, he's got nothing but pain left. I actually was thinking of Bill Cosby exactly as well, which is, you know, for whatever it's worth, nobody can watch the Cosby Show anymore without wondering, right? And and he was great and, you know, fantastic comedian. But I think in this definition, Bill Cosby will die with pain. I think actually if Bill Cosby had not been found out by this definition, I would say he would have died without pain. So it's, to me, I interpret it at least as a bit of, you know, kind of with your reputation intact and with a certain satisfaction with your life.
So by that, we would conclude that Sophocles could say that if you were a mass murderer but died comfortably, then you lived a good life. So Stalin actually was Sophocles' ideal.
No, because Sophocles doesn't say you lived a good life. He said happy life. That's different.
Okay, so a happy life.
But if you
different from, because Antigone lived a good life. I don't think she lived a very unhappy life. So it's not goodness and happiness, not the same thing.
Right. But happiness here is blessedness. You see, I just have to question whether what he's saying there is really what he means to say. Because countless examples you can bring up of people who died very comfortably in their beds.
Right.
Leading a happy life, I don't know. You know, like I said, Stalin, Pol Pot.
Right. Now. So isn't that why we have heaven and hell, you know?
But I also think it has to do with, and again, I think it's psychological in a sense that it's what's in their minds. Are their minds clean? Are their minds good? And
right. Yes,
someone said if Bill Cosby was never found out, would he die a happy man? Well, it depends. Would he have ever had remorse? Would something maybe have happened that he would have realized he was wrong? And even though it never came out, he would have felt in himself the remorse, or he would have felt guilt, or had not died a happy man, we wouldn't know one way or the other. But it's more, even if you've done bad things, have you atoned for them? Have you made amends? Have you, you know, asked for forgiveness? All these things, I don't think it's necessarily, oh, I didn't get caught, I got to lead a good life, I'm happy. I don't take it that way. I take it more internal.
Good. Yeah. Right. Let's take the example of someone on death row. You know, they've committed some bad things. Maybe they're a mass murderer. You know, do they have absolutely no hope? I mean, at all? Do they have nothing to be happy about at all? You know, can they not be happy somehow with something in themselves? I don't know. You know, the Stoics would argue yes. There's always something that we can be satisfied with. No matter what's happened to us, but we have to face it, I think. We have to reconcile it somehow in ourselves. So, yeah, I don't think Bill Cosby would have been happy. He just may not have told everybody, right? We may not have known. But, you know, now everyone knows, so it's less secret.
Well, we don't know if Stalin or Hitler or Pol Pot, we don't know if they were happy. I mean, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But I'm just saying that it's, if you say count no man happy, it's not, I mean, there are martyrs also who we're not discussing, you know, who died in a lot of pain. And they're hugely admired, not for their happiness.
Yeah. Both of these examples, the one at the end of Oedipus and the one in the Herodotus, deal with external materials, material goods and so forth, as a definition of happiness. So, you know, in that respect, then Oedipus is not someone to be envied, just as they say, right? But that still leaves open the possibility for people to, you know, decide what's going to make them happy, you know, whether they have material items or not. And, you know, without that being in the equation, then, you know, you have a whole other discussion.
You know, I wonder if you can just apply the test to the previous plays we read. So,
yeah.
By this definition, Agamemnon died in possession of everything that he ever had in life. So, he was happy, right?
He had a lot to be happy about. Yeah, he had a lot to be happy about. He made it home, he won the war, and yeah, you're right.
So, Clytemnestra likewise died a happy death and was happy. I just don't think it goes. I think one of the things that I think is underlined here is, in fact, maybe you shouldn't call any man happy, and maybe you shouldn't really be worried about happiness, because if it all comes down to when you die, then you can't even know when you're happy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's basically what it comes down to is you think you're happy now, but you don't really know until you die. That's a really odd way of looking at it. I don't know if I'm happy until I die.
That's what it's saying, I think. But on the other hand, you know, for the Stoic lens, for instance, that's not part of the equation, you know. So we can determine how happy we are with or without external, events and external material. So I like it. Yeah.
No, the reason I thought it was philosophical, I don't know that it's, you know, I don't know so much about happiness or the end. I mean, you know, it starts out with the chorus saying, you know, not just that Oedipus was like Agamemnon and he had power. Here's Oedipus who solved the famous riddle and rose to power. I mean, he accomplished
it. Oh, yeah,
what's
originally that, you know, it's so real.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I can't hear you.
Oh, what citizen did not look upon his life with envy? You know, it's sort of like a statement of, you know, we think we lead lives even when we accomplish something, and what does it amount to? You know, it's a very, you know, kind of fatalistic, kind of view that there's nothing, you don't really know until, you know, everybody dies. It's sort of another way of saying, look, everybody dies no matter how accomplished you are, how much you solve the riddle and rise to power. That's sort of how I understand, what the chorus is saying at the end.
But okay. Also, now I took it, to, again, to be, well, it's like, I didn't take it that way. It's like, it says, you know, everybody envied him, but look what happened to him. Look at the grim disaster. And I think, to me, it was more like, you know, material wealth, fame, power, all that, that doesn't give you a good life, that doesn't make you happy necessarily. And again, it's your own internal, how am I living my life? Am I happy with who I am? Am I happy with what I've done? And
yeah.
Then, and that's where I take that, till he has crossed life's boundary free of pain. And the free of pain to me means no regrets, that I've done what I should have done, and if I've done something wrong, I've atoned for it or made amends or have gotten absolution, whatever. That's what I took for the free of pain, not physical pain or not having anything bad happen to me.
Those are our 21st century values. And, you know, I don't...
But a lot of the stories and a lot of the myths and everything do with greed and, you know, that, look at King Midas, you know, that money and wealth isn't necessarily what you should be going after.
Here's,
a lot of the stories have that kind of moral to them.
But that's not Oedipus's story, is it? I mean,
I think that's more of a modern moral. I mean, I think in Ovid at least, Midas is just a fool. All sorts of people suggest pursue wealth successfully. I mean, I think, and as far as like, I think what the chorus is driving at in those last lines is, if you die without the gods coming down on you, and that's, the gods came down on Agamemnon, they came down on Clytemnestra, and they came down on Odysseus. I mean, Odysseus, I beg your pardon, they came down on Oedipus. Yeah.
Well, maybe it also might say something like, and I'm not 100% behind this because I haven't thought it through completely, but one thing that it could be saying is, look, there's no cause for envy. You don't know what's going on inside someone else's head.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, look, here it is. He looks like he's got everything. Everyone was envious of him. But when you look upon someone like that, you don't really know. You have no idea. And no one really has any idea. And so maybe...
You know.
You know, going back to that envy is maybe the key there in some ways.
I want to...
Oedipus, because he made his own act of contrition at the end, crossed his life's boundary, was free of pain, because he made his act of contrition in this world. And the kind of and the chorus leader is kind of, you know, giving Oedipus a pass because he atoned for his sins. And I can move forward.
Yeah.
Andre.
Yes.
this is going back a few years, when you used to send out like the questions to think about what we were reading,
yeah,
and you would put a quote usually at the beginning, or I believe you give us like a quote or something.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you give us one quote? Because I loved the quote, and it goes to what someone just mentioned about going, you know, in someone's life. It's I forget who said it, but be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Doesn't that sound familiar? I don't remember where that came from.
Yeah, I know it's attributed to the Buddha,
uh-huh,
amongst others. It's probably one of those that has multiple attributions.
Yeah, and you know,
it was
attributed
to Porphyry. That's not supposed to be valid.
Yeah, and the Greeks,
you know,
they didn't know. Yeah. Sorry.
Well,
so,
for Oedipus, I mean, I think his life is a real nightmare. I mean, I guess everybody would agree with this, but his whatever he thought was true, the opposite was true. I mean, it wasn't as though he wasn't, I thought he was a good person and a good king. He seemed to really have compassion for the people, and really the country is in a terrible state, and he's trying to fix things, you know, and to save his people. And but it turns out that everything that he did, which he thought was right and good, turned out to be bad and exactly the opposite of what he thought. And I think, I mean, there certainly are people who are unfortunate that way in life, that they, you know, follow a certain leader, or they do everything, you know, they try to be good parents, so they do the opposite of what their parents did, but then it kind of doesn't work out. You know, but people really are trying, and he sort of has the worst possible fate, you know?
Yeah, we're kind of running late here. I want us to keep thinking about this, and I want us to also talk more next time about Antigone and Ismene, who both have to also reconcile, you know, their decisions, right, about what they're going to do about their brother. And we talked a little bit about Creon tonight, but I think Phil and I thought if we didn't really get through Antigone, we probably should devote some time to that next time. So I'd like to propose that, and we also next time we have Paul Cartledge scheduled to be on the call with us. So we can kind of like bring this up. I think, and I can't wait to tell Phil about our conversation tonight, because he's got to listen to this. It's been great. But we're also talking about, you know, maybe extending maybe one more discussion in August. We had originally scheduled the discussions through July, I think. So if y'all are interested in that, you know, think about it and let us know if you'd like us to schedule another discussion. We didn't get to talk about Antigone, and we may not have time enough to talk about Electra next meeting. So maybe we'll extend it. So think about that.
Well, I vote yes. So
okay. Yeah, I vote yes. I don't need to think about it.
Yes. Good. I'd like to do that too. And so we'll set that up. Phil will set it up. Okay.
Right.
But we're going to good. Let's kind of conclude it for now, and think about it some more. And then, if you haven't read Antigone yet, definitely read it. But if you have, maybe reread it, or go ahead and start Electra, Sophocles' Electra. We'll see if we have. We'll definitely get to that in August then, for sure. We'll get to Electra. And we were hoping to pair Euripides' Electra with it, which will bring us back to the Oresteia, you know. So,
cool.
All right, any final comments or questions or anything? Okay, well, this has been really good.
It's always great.
Yeah,
thank you,
really
Dan.
Good. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Okay. All right.
Good night.
Good night.